You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, rising temperatures in Wisconsin are causing shorter winters, hotter summers, and some economic problems, too. We'll talk to a scientist about where climate change is being felt the most here in the state. First, there's a special immigrant status for victims of certain violent crimes, including domestic violence and sexual assault. It's called the U non-immigrant status, and it's commonly referred to as a U visa. Advocates say these visas allow victims to work, drive, and leave an abuser, which could literally save lives. There's one problem, though, the wait list. The wait to be approved for a U visa can take anywhere from 3 upwards to 10 years. The immigration status was created under the Violence Against Women Act, and it's funded until next year. Some advocates say they're worried that the funding would end or be slashed under the current administration. Robin Dalton is a senior immigration attorney at Rise Law Center in Madison. It's a nonprofit focusing on family and immigration law. Robin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us, please, what is this U visa, this U non-immigrant status?
Okay, so the U non-immigrant status, it was established in 2000 under the Trafficking Victims and Protection Act, and basically it was created with a dual purpose. So the first purpose was to provide a humanitarian relief to victims of crime who suffered either substantial physical or mental harm, but it was also used as a tool for law enforcement to help create a safer community through requiring cooperation in the investigation related to the crime.
And who would qualify to apply for this status?
There's generally three factors. So the first, again, is proving that the person is a victim of a qualifying crime. The crime is generally a crime that's violent in nature and often involves physical violence. The person also has to have information about the crime and have been helpful to law enforcement. And additionally, they have to prove that they've suffered substantial mental or physical abuse as a result of the criminal activity.
And to be clear, these are crimes that have taken place in the borders of the United States. This is not something for someone who's been a victim of a crime in another country to seek status here. Is that right?
Yep. It has to be done within the borders of the United States, or it could be somewhere where U.S. has jurisdiction, like a military base, for example.
And what is the application process like then?
So the application process right now is really long, but just to start off, before you even file an application, each applicant has to provide their own account of the crime that occurred. This is something that oftentimes is really difficult and can re-traumatize victims of crime, as it might be the first time they're really writing down and divulging all of the details of the abuse that they suffered as a result of the crime. Additionally, each application has to include a signed certification, which is an immigration document that law enforcement signs off on, in which they, again, are reiterating that this person was a victim of a crime, that they helped in the cooperation, and that it was traumatic to them. This certification is something that is discretionary, so not every agency will sign off on it. And without the certification, the applicant can't apply, just like without their personal statement, they can't apply. And then beyond these two things, which are mandatory, there's a whole host of other documents and information gathering to get the application together. So typically, once we're filing an application, it's well over 100 pages just for this one application.
And I know there are a variety of people who might apply for this, but it sounds like a common case might be someone who's been a victim of domestic abuse or domestic violence and who might be expected to be reluctant to report a crime to the police for fear of deportation. And in some cases, maybe the perpetrator even held out that threat to keep that person from reporting the crime. Is that a fairly common use of this visa?
Yeah, I would say more often than not, our clients are either victims of sexual assault or domestic violence. And oftentimes, yes, the perpetrators of the crime use their immigration status against them. So knowing that if somebody's undocumented or underdocumented, that they might have an increased fear of actually reporting to law enforcement, and oftentimes abusers will take advantage of that to perpetuate crimes against undocumented or underdocumented persons.
We're talking to Robin Dalton from the Rise Law Center in Madison, looking at the U visa, the U non-immigrant status, and a growing wait list for this status. Robin, can you talk about that? Why are we seeing a wait list growing in the United States?
So when Congress established the Trafficking and Victims Protection Act of 2000, they set the cap at 10,000 U-Visa applications that could be adjudicated per year. And actually, when I first started doing this work, you couldn't even get a U-Visa, although it had already been in law for nearly 10 years, because they just hadn't created a process for it yet. So the first almost 10 years is you don't see any of these. And then around 2009, you start getting the U-approvals, and those start maxing out almost immediately. So in the first few years where U-Visas were available, we would see people getting their approvals or denials, their decisions, within about a year, oftentimes much less than a year, like 8 months, 9 months. And now what we're looking at is when somebody actually applies, they're waiting about 3 to 4 years to see if they're even approvable. If they are approvable, they're put on a wait list, but they won't get a full approval till about 10 years after their application is filed. And the reason for this is simply because since there's only 10,000 that are allowable per year, and currently there's over 100,000 processing, just mathematically, we can't make it go any quicker.
And there wasn't that wait list at first. It was handled in a few months. Is it just a backlog slowly grew, or was there a change somewhere along the way that slowed things down?
A backlog slowly grew initially, and then it just skyrocketed over the last probably 4 years. It's just absolutely skyrocketed. So it started, there was a lot of applications sort of in process, because like I said, for that first almost 10 years, they weren't granting U-Visas, so there were people applying, but it was also a relatively unknown or underused option within immigration because there wasn't a process in place. Once the process was actually put into place, more people started feeling comfortable coming forward and affirmatively filing something with immigration. Because it's really scary, right, for somebody who already might have a fear of law enforcement and a fear of immigration to just affirmatively give their information to an immigration agency. But once people started seeing like, oh, hey, this is something that's safe, these are getting granted, these are getting worked on, more and more people started applying, and also more and more attorneys, accredited reps, and legal services agencies became aware of this option.
And can you talk about what it means for an applicant to have that waiting period go from months to potentially a decade?
Yeah, so it is just really heartbreaking. Applicants are waiting for an excruciatingly long time. Some people say, oh, if it's going to be 10 years, I don't even know if I want to apply. I don't know that it's worth it, especially if they're paying, you know, high attorney's fees at some places. It also means that while this application is pending, there's no ability to apply to travel outside of the United States. So oftentimes, survivors are forced with making really difficult decisions. We get phone calls from clients who ask if they should leave the United States when they have either a parent or a child who's just really sick, terminally ill, or has just passed away. And I don't really have a good answer for this because I always advise my clients, it's really up to them. There's no guarantee that they'll be able to come back into the United States until there's a decision on their application. And obviously, if it's not approved, then it could be that they are never allowed to come back in. And so there's really tough choices to make for people now that the processing times are so long.
Now, this backlog, it sounds like, was in place before Donald Trump was elected president. He, of course, had talked a lot about immigration restrictions. Has he changed the landscape for these U visas?
At this point, no. There was already a backlog ahead of time. It has continued to grow and grow and grow. There isn't a specific policy that he's made specifically to U visas. But there are a lot of policies that have changed for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, or other violent crimes. So, for example, previously, if somebody applied for a U visa and if for any reason they came on to ICE's radar, ICE would really use their discretion and look at enforcement priorities that were set by the prior administration and say, okay, if you're a victim of domestic violence, sexual assault, that you're not an enforcement priority, so we don't need to try to remove you from the United States, you know, immediately. So what would happen is if they saw that somebody had a U visa application pending, or even if they didn't, but they saw that they were a victim of crime, they might say, let's wait, you know, give them the opportunity to apply for this visa, and if they're approved, then we'll go ahead and terminate any deportation or removal proceedings. Now what's happening is oftentimes ICE jurisdictions are pushing for the deportation or removal of e-visa applicants.
And as we wrap up, Robin, are there changes that you think could help with this backlog?
Yeah, so probably the best and most impactful change would be to remove or at a minimum raise the 10,000 cap on U-visas. This would help with the backlog, and so this would help applications process much quicker. Things that would also be helpful but definitely not as highly important to me as raising this cap would be provision for travel for U-visa holders and applicants who are waitlisted, so that when there are these dire circumstances, there is the ability to travel without the fear that they will not be able to come back in. And then obviously just more funding for agencies that are at all levels that are serving survivors of violence. So this could be immigration adjudicators, law enforcement agencies, legal service agencies, increased protections for survivors of violence from threats of deportation, and increased social services for underdocumented survivors of violence.
Robin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Robin Dalton is a senior immigration attorney at Rise Law Center in Madison. She joined us to talk about the U non-immigrant status, or U visa, and why there's such a long wait list. First, a lot of conversations about climate change focus on what could happen in the future. But in Wisconsin, the impacts are already being felt. Temperatures have risen statewide, leading to shorter winters, untimely thaws, and hotter summers, among other things. The changing climate also creates challenges for the state's economy, from the recreation industry to disaster relief needed for victims of severe flooding. Current models warn that without action, these problems could get worse. Michael Notaro is an associate director and senior scientist at the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. He's with us now in the studio. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, the Institute for Climate Change Impacts has measured temperatures in the state over time and trying to project them into the future. What trends are we seeing here?
Sure. I would like to show the observed changes in our state have been pretty heterogeneous. So far, we've had the greatest amount of warming in the central and northwest Wisconsin, particularly in winter and spring. And those warming has been about 3 degrees Fahrenheit since the past, say, 6 decades. And the state's also getting wetter. In particular, the southern counties are now getting about 6 inches of rain more per year than we got back in the 1950s. We also have more extreme precipitation events. And fewer cold nights and a longer growing season. So in terms of projections, our global and regional climate models are showing that by the end of the century, Wisconsin will probably be about 6 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer annually and wetter throughout the year, particularly the cold season. And the frequency of heavy precipitation events is expected to increase, like, for example, about a 40 to 60% increase in the frequency of days over 3 inches by the end of the century.
Well, let's pick some of that apart now. And you mentioned the temperature increases being heterogeneous. And, you know, we see an overall number, but it sounds like in a place like Wisconsin, it really varies by season, and those winters are accounting for a lot of the warming. Am I reading that right?
That's correct. The winter and springs have had the most warming, and then also depending on what part of the state the warming has changed. Part of it is that once you get to a smaller spatial scale, you start to see a little more noise in the patterns as opposed to more of a global scale. But in general, the warming's biggest in central and northern Wisconsin, northwest Wisconsin, and the increase in rainfall and precipitation is biggest in the southern part of the state.
Let's talk about some of the impacts of that. And some people might say warmer winters, it doesn't sound so bad, but I mentioned, you know, the recreation industry in the winter, things like snowmobiling, ice fishing. Are there changes that are affecting their bottom lines here?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously big effects on the cold season in terms of our cold season industry. If you look at changes in snow and ice in our state, for example, Lake Mendota now has an ice season that's about a month shorter than it used to be. The Great Lakes are a lot more open in terms of water and lack of ice. And by the end of the century, we're predicting anywhere from like 4 to 7 weeks less with snow on the ground. So that has large impacts. So you can think about hunting, fishing, wildlife impacts. As you have less snow on the ground, that helps deer mobility and they survive more. If you have less snow and you have warmer temperatures, then dabbling ducks like mallards migrate south later. So you might have mallards migrating south further into, say, January and February. And then you have examples for evil and cold water fish in streams. When if you have high temperatures, that limits their reproduction. So we'd expect that brown and brook trout are not going to do so well.
You mentioned Lake Mendota, which I understand because it happens to be right next to the Center for Limnology. I've heard it's the most studied lake in the world, and we've got information going back decades, what, 150 years and more?
Yeah.
Are we starting to get that kind of information? I know it doesn't go back as far. Are we getting better long-term information about other lakes around the state?
Yeah. Well, we have data, actually. There's even been a study by Catherine O'Reilly in which she's analyzing global lake temperature trends and showing most of the global lakes have been warming. The Great Lakes, Northern Europe and Southwest U.S. has been the biggest warming rates for lakes. So we are among the hotspot regions for lakes warming at a very rapid rate.
Talking to Michael Notaro, he's with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison, looking at the impacts of climate change here in Wisconsin. Now let's look at the summer a little bit and possible impacts. I understand that there's a higher risk of sustained periods of high heat in the state. Is that right?
Yeah. So far, the observational data for the last few decades has not shown a change towards more extreme heat, but the models are showing eventually we'll be progressing in that region. That's what most places in the world have been experiencing, extreme heat.
So let's talk agriculture then. Like right now, without having those extreme heat stretches out of the ordinary, some farmers are getting longer growing seasons. That's often good news. But between the risk of extreme heat and then high precipitation events, flooding in particular, can you talk about the up and downside there?
Yeah, in terms of agricultural effects, we know that plant hardiness zones are already shifting northward. We know that even potentially for gardening aspects that plants that are grown in central and southern U.S. might be grown at the end of the century in our southeastern counties of Wisconsin. There was a report basically from Risky Business for the Midwest, which indicated for our state that corn would suffer a lot, particularly from the fact that it's going to get warmer in the future, that wheat might potentially benefit. We also know that corn is particularly vulnerable to extreme heat. And then likewise, on the other side, having more CO2 in the atmosphere is also favorable for the plants. So you'd have more photosynthesis, plants are more water use efficient. So there's pros and cons, but the risk is that with more extreme heat, more droughts, that you're going to have more vulnerability to crop loss.
Let's talk about flooding now, because we've seen a bunch of high profile floods, as I think about it, in just about every corner of the state, it seems like, over the last 10, 20 years. Are we just paying more attention, or are we actually getting more acute flooding lately?
Wisconsin and pretty much a lot of the world is getting more extreme heavy precipitation events. And the reason is as the air gets warmer, it can hold more moisture. So when you have a weather system pass through, you can dump that much more of moisture. It's kind of like a sponge effect. So I could give an example. Since 1939 for Madison, we've been collecting weather observations. If you look at the top 20 rainfall events, half of them have occurred since the turn of the century alone, so in recent years. And we've had more frequent events of over 3 inches in the last decade than we had in the 6 decades combined. So we're definitely getting more extreme precipitation events, and those have very large ecological effects, for example.
And that sounds like a consequence of climate change that's kind of hard to prepare for, because you could say overall the state's getting a few more inches of rain a year, but it makes a difference if you're in the part that got no more rain or if you're in the part that got 20 inches more rain all in the course of one weekend.
Yeah, and the southern part of our state, including Dane County, has really experienced a huge increase in precipitation, heavy precipitation events. The change in the mean climate, I mean, it's not really going to have huge resource effects. It's really the changes in your extremes. So fewer cold nights, more extreme heat, more extreme precipitation, where precipitation gets distributed into fewer events, produces heavy flooding, stormwater overflows, crop damage, for example.
And then another consequence I've heard about is the risk of disease spread or disease-carrying organism spread. What are we seeing in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's certainly the case, depending on which kind of resource you're talking about. We know that, I think, in terms of our state forests, for example, if you have an increase in temperatures and also an increase in drought, they become more vulnerable to pests and disease. So that becomes an increased condition. So there's also risk to human health, obviously, with extreme heat and also with sewage overflows from heavy rainfall events and resulting cryptosporidium outbreaks in lakes.
And I wanted to ask, with just our last couple of minutes left, what do you see from the state in reacting, the state government in reacting to this?
Well, so far, there's been a lot of restrictions going on in our state. The DNR Science Bureau, particularly, did some work on climate change, has been, in essence, shut down. That's kind of made it complicated for our research groups to collaborate in that area. There's also on both the federal and state level, there's a significant reduction in federal funds and state funds that are available for doing research on climate change. At the same time, we continue to do excellent work both at the Center for Climatic Research and the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, and we continue to do work related to climate adaptation.
And could the state and local government, say, be doing more to adapt as these changes are happening?
Certainly. What we need to do is both the balance of mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is to reduce emissions, and adaptation is to adjust to negative climate impacts. We've done some work on exploring some potential strategies to reduce some of the negative impacts. That was one of the focus on Wiki that I allude to. And upcoming in 2019, we're going to have a significant contribution of Wiki and CCR in terms of the natural adaptation for which is likely to occur in our state, in our city.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Michael Notaro. He's Associate Director and Senior Scientist at the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. He joined us today to look at how Wisconsin is feeling the effects of climate change now, not just in the future. First, more often than not, protests get mixed reactions from the public. People criticize the issue at hand or how the protest is done, the time, the place, and more. But there are protests and protesters that most Americans are likely to regard as good. Looking back at Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., even the Boston Tea Party, their actions are considered positive and live in history books. But at the time, officials in Montgomery and supporters of segregation around the nation didn't like Parks or King, and the British Crown presumably didn't think too highly of the Boston Tea Party either. So what has to happen before controversial disobedience is eventually considered a, quote, good protest worthy of our kids' history books? Kevin Gover is the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, where he has overseen exhibits on protests. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, a lot changes when we're looking at a protest that's happening now versus looking at it through the lens of history. How do you approach that distance in your museum?
Well, I suppose we, like everyone else, I mean, I think you nailed it in your introduction. In the moment, very rarely are protests widely thought to be a good thing. As you point out, Dr. King's protests were a clear majority of Americans didn't think that they were a good idea. And that's true of pretty much every mass social movement, is that they are not thought of as being a good thing in their time. And it's only when the society sort of catches up with the position that the protesters are advancing that we look back and say, yeah, that Rosa Parks, what a hero. Yeah, that Martin Luther King, what a hero. And it's, you know, they don't always succeed. In fact, I think it's fair to say, I suspect that most protests fail, most protest movements. And so I think it is in some part has to do with the, obviously, the nature of the issue, the character of the leadership in a particular movement, and their wisdom and acumen and ability to understand sort of both the national zeitgeist and the political realities in the moment. It depends on what the media chooses to do, and that's becoming a more and more complicated question now, as social media begins to have such an effect, and we all can seek out the media with the point of view that we prefer. And so so all of that is to say, I don't think it's possible to predict. Think back, I remember, you know, in 1968, when those athletes raised their black gloved fist at the Mexico Olympics. And, man, I'll tell you, I didn't know anybody who thought that was a great thing. And yet now those men are ensconced in the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and thought of as cultural heroes and for their protest. So you know, looking at it in the moment, we're almost always going to get it wrong, I think.
Do we get it right when we look at it later, though? Because when we look back at the civil rights movement, I mean, as I learned it early on, it's this simple story. Bad things are happening. Rosa Parks sat on the bus. Martin Luther King gave the I Have a Dream speech. Things got better. I'm oversimplifying even an oversimplified version. But do we tend to sanitize and miss all the false starts and the other people that we didn't know about when we look back?
Oh, absolutely we do. And we do that, you know, we do that both in our understanding of our national history, and frankly, we do it in understanding our personal history. I mean, you know, I like that good story about myself as opposed to the more complex, messy one where I did things that weren't so good. And I think as a country, and not just the U.S., but any country will tend to do that and choose the tidier version of history. It's very difficult for us to really embrace the complexity and acknowledge the ambiguity and even the unmitigated evil that exists in our history.
We're talking to Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, about political protest and how we talk about it and represent it as it's happening and in history. Kevin, I want to look at a couple current day examples. You mentioned a sports-related protest in 1968, and there's a lot of sports-related protests, the kneeling during the national anthem in the NFL and some other professional sports. As you look at that, what are you thinking about as far as the conversation?
Well, I'm thinking about, I think that protest can be effective when it is associated with a broader political/legal/social strategy to make real progress on an issue. So if these athletes are protesting police violence against black men, and it's yet to be seen whether that will be followed up with real changes in our social circumstances so that black men are not targeted unfairly. And I think that is very much an open question. You know, and I think there's a real risk that the protests sort of peter out over time if there's not a clear social, legal, political strategy for pressing forward on the issue.
A lot of the argument there, the public argument, hasn't been so much in the content, the goals of what the players are looking for, but the timing. During the national anthem, the argument is that's not the appropriate time. Has this been an argument about protests that we've been talking about in American history?
Sure, always. You know, they said that it was not the appropriate time for the athletes in 1968. To protest any time except during the playing of the anthem while they're receiving their medals. And of course, from their perspective, it was, well, what better time? When else is everybody going to be focused on us? And so that's the moment of greatest impact. And I'm sure that's much of the thought that the NFL players have right now. I mean, if they went and held a press conference after the game, I'm not so sure that many people are going to show up, and it certainly wouldn't be televised.
And another current protest going on involves pipelines, and this is an issue led in many cases by Native Americans from a variety of tribes around the country. And this was an issue at your museum, a centerpiece from the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, went on display at the National Museum of the American Indian. Why did you want to have that on display?
Well, of course, part of our job at the National Museum of the American Indian is to document contemporary Native American life. And it just so happened that we had an exhibition about treaties between the United States and the Indian nations. And at its heart, for the Cheyenne River and Standing Rock Sioux, the issue was about treaty and treaty property and treaty rights. And so it was clearly relevant to the story we were trying to tell about these treaties, and so we were very glad to receive this object that really embodies what was going on at Standing Rock, with all of these different tribes coming together to protest on behalf of the rights, the treaty rights of a couple of tribes.
I think a lot of times when people go to a museum, maybe me too, I expect it to be about the past. This is stuff that already happened, and a concern people might have is, well, this is a current issue on display at the museum. How do you see that fitting into the role of a museum?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always have to be very careful in curating the present. For the reasons you and I were just discussing, it's very difficult to get a complete perspective in the moment on what it is we're seeing and what its significance really is. And so, you know, we have to try to be very humble and very fair in our presentation. You know, it simply wouldn't be true to say those of us who work at the museum are objective. But I think that it is fair to say that we're scrupulous about being honest about what we say. And so our presentation of the issue describes what happened, described how the tribes came together to object and to protest the pipeline. And then, you know, we do not say what our opinion is about what the outcome should be, because that's just not our place.
Kevin Gover is with us. He's director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. We're looking at the history of protest in the U.S., which protests we deem good in the moment or later on, and why. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think qualifies as a good protest? Are there lines that protesters should and shouldn't cross? What are they? Is it okay if they ruffle feathers in order to get attention to the cause they're working on? And were you involved with a protest movement now or at some point in your life? How did you feel about the way people talked about it? How do you feel about history looks back on it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing the conversation now with Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. We're looking at the history of protest in the United States and when we deem protests good and appropriate, bad and inappropriate, and how we look back on them through the pages of history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think is an example of a good protest, an effective protest? When is a protest not justified? And you can look at ones current, the ones that during the national anthem or the pipeline protests or the civil rights era. What do you think of the way we talk about the civil rights era protest? Did you live through that? Did you participate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kevin, as you were talking a few moments ago, I thought of the protests this year related to the removal of Confederate monuments. I mean, those themselves came into place 40 or 50 years after the Civil War. So that was one view of history. Now we're reviewing it. We never get the final draft, do we?
No. And that's a very important point. We are constantly revisiting and revising our history. And I think it's a natural process that collectively somehow we come to different conclusions over time, and it's very interesting to me when people try to push back against the conclusion that the society is reaching. And so, for example, a number of scholars and a number of civic and political groups worked very hard, including, I might add, the Ku Klux Klan, to say that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about states' rights, and it was a noble endeavor, and it was a lost cause, but the Confederacy was a good thing. Well, you know, these days, most historians would say, well, no, the war was about slavery, and the defeat of the Confederate Army is an unambiguous good. But the other interesting thing about that is we've got this history all around us in our public spaces, and we rarely bother to think about what it means. And so, you know, finally someone stands and ponders, well, what does it mean to have a Confederate general in the center of a major public space? What does it mean to have Christopher Columbus, who was a villain to Native American people, being honored in so many of our major cities in very significant ways, in D.C. and New York, and really in many parts of the country? And I'm actually a little less interested in the outcome. I guess I don't believe in the destruction of these things. I believe in that we should interpret them in light of our modern sensibilities and say, this is who this guy really was. This is what this person was really fighting for. And even go so far as to say, in the case of Confederate generals, his defeat was an unambiguous good because 4 million people were freed from slavery. But that requires a very mature society, and one that really is willing to embrace the complexity of history. That's why I think Europeans are better at it than we are. They've become more comfortable with the complexities of their history. But it's because, you know, their cultures are much older than the American culture.
I want to bring on our callers now. Steve is with us in Danbury. Steve, hi.
Hi. Of course, it's important to consider the impact that your protest is going to have. You want to make sure that your behavior isn't going to negatively impact the cause. In the case of the NFL players, I support them 100% in taking a knee. And I think it's interesting when you're talking about the Dakota Pipeline and the NFL players, you're talking about minority groups who are typically disenfranchised and don't have access to the media. And so they choose the only means they have of getting their message out. And I salute the bravery of the NFL players. And I think it's obvious that they're having an impact. They've even drawn the ire of the President of the United States. And I hope they continue to do it in a respectful manner the way they have so far.
Steve, thanks for the call. Steve, giving one perspective on those protests. Kevin, your thoughts?
Well, I think that that's right, that it's very easy. It would be very easy for the players to lose the support of those who support them by behaving obnoxiously or by using the wrong language in describing what they're doing. It is a very subtle thing. I think that we have to acknowledge, though, at least from the polling I've seen, that they do not enjoy majority support, at least among NFL fans, for what they're doing. And so it's not a perfect solution. But I agree with the caller that they're doing it in the way they're doing it and the time they're doing it because that's the way to bring attention to the issue they believe in.
Steve, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kevin Gover, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, talking about protest and how we talk about protest. Lynn is on the line now in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Rob and Kevin. I've been involved in some protests, and there is generally a contingent among us who volunteers to act out within the law and risk getting arrested because that's the only way the general press will cover the issue. It's very uncomfortable. It's not a walk in the park. It's not a bunch of spoiled people just out trying to get their way. But until we acknowledge that there's injustice, there's no other way to go about it, I don't see.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, the idea of civil disobedience, of course, Kevin, has a long history in protest. And Lynn saying, if you want to get people's attention, the media's attention, that may be the only way sometimes.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case, and history would bear that out. A peaceful civil disobedience can make the protesters the sympathetic parties. That's certainly what happened during the civil rights movement. And the response of the authorities to that peaceful civil disobedience really drove more people into their camp. Most folks are a little smarter than they were in the South in the 1960s in using their power against against peaceful protest. But you know, sometimes it is dangerous, and I really do have great respect for peaceful civil disobedience.
I want to bring up the concept of kind of mixing the spheres of our lives. And this is, has a lot to do with the sports protest. People do say sometimes, yeah, your cause, maybe I agree with it, maybe I don't. But what if we're talking about sports or comics or computer games or whatever, I don't want politics bleeding over. I get plenty of that everywhere else. Is it appropriate for people to kind of cross those the genres, the entertainment and the politics?
Well, I don't know what part of our lives are immune from that, and there's just a long, unbroken history of our entertainers somehow being involved or bringing politics to the table. Now, you know, you're not going to see an NFL player stop in the middle of a play and hold up a sign. Because they're football players and they're going to do their job. But when they're not doing that, why shouldn't they be able to express themselves? We look to them as heroes and people to be admired, many of us do, and they choose to use that influence and whatever charisma they might possess to advance an issue that they feel strongly about. I don't think there's any part of American life that's immune. I mean, we even have politics in our churches. And most folks apparently don't object to that because the churches have become very important in social and political movements. So, no, I don't think there's a place in American life that is immune. At least none comes to mind for me.
Well, Kevin, we're going to leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Kevin Gover. He's the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He joined us to look at the past and present of protests in America and which protests are regarded as good or valid in U.S. history. Still time for you to share your thoughts on these issues. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your thoughts and maybe your own experiences while you're at it.